Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is October 14th. It's 6:15 a.m. right now. I'm looking out my window and watching the sunrise. The sky is a beautiful dark pink color, like steak. I'm up and at 'em early today because there's a lot to do, including this episode. I've got a couple of exciting announcements. I got to be on Sovereign Tech with Brian Sovereign, who you know. You should be listening to that show, but you should also know Brian from Conspirathon. And we also did a nice Patreon-only show on health, fitness, and diet topics. And a little bit of life extension technology talk in there as well. All that will be coming your way next week. On the show today, you're going to hear my interview with Professor John Hassness from Georgetown University. And we're going to talk about two articles that he wrote within the last year. The first is called The Surprising Obstacle That Mizzou and Yale Face in Increasing Diversity, which talks about how challenging it actually is, because of the Civil Rights Act, to favor identity diversity in faculty hiring. But we're going to contrast that with another piece and another idea he presented in the Wall Street Journal earlier this year called The One Kind of Diversity Colleges Avoid. In this article, Professor Hassness talks about how limitation, obstacle, and constraint-free the practice of building ideological or intellectual diversity into a faculty actually is. But most higher education institutes still make no effort to do it. This is another show, like the one I did with Christina Hoff Summers, where I expect a person's experience to have an informative and soothing effect on what has been, for me, over the last year, some very hostile attitudes and presentations on these higher education subjects. So that being said, I'm looking over the outline for today's show, and I feel like I should issue a kind of disclaimer. The first half of this presentation is designed to agitate you, because everybody's life is different, and every person's plate is a different level of full. Some of you might not feel like you are in a space where you can afford to be rankled. Like maybe you're an oral surgeon. You listen to School Sucks while you take out wisdom teeth. How pissed can you afford to be right now? But the second half of this presentation is designed to reduce agitation by providing new information. How lovely. Anyway, yesterday, I'm in the drugstore, and I suddenly find myself screaming at the cashier, why is there candy corn everywhere in here? What's going on? This is gross. And she said, Brett, she knew my name. She said, this is for Halloween. The kids love candy corn for their Halloween celebrations. And I said to her, oh, you know, this reminds me that it is almost the 1 year anniversary of that embarrassing fracas at Yale. That was just last year. That seems like ages ago. And she looked at me like really confused. And I said, you don't know the story about the Yale students freaking out about culturally inappropriate Halloween costumes? She shook her head and she said, Brett, I'm sure you're overreacting. Yale University is populated entirely by adults, and adults don't freak out about things like Halloween costumes. Most adults don't even dress up for Halloween. And I was astonished. I said, ma'am, you're surrounded by newspapers here at the counter of CVS. You don't remember? You didn't hear anything about this story? And she said, Brett, these newspapers, look, it's like Kardashian, Kardashian, Trump, 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 Kardashian. So if it didn't fit into one of their ordeals, I probably didn't see it. I said, well, a lot has happened. And what I said next, I feel really bad about because it was really presumptuous and kind of stereotypical. I said, well, you know, you're working here at CVS. You probably don't know much about the college experience. She said, oh, no, I have a master's degree in communications from Cornell University. I said, I have a degree in communications, too. What year did you graduate? And she said, 1994. I said, mine was 2000, right? The egg on our face. Holy crap. So anyway, none of this story is real. But this fictional woman is an example of, a lot of people, maybe even in this audience, don't know this Yale story. So I want to get into it in a little bit of detail before we move on with today's show. Now, first of all, I'm being very nasty and negative. No one at Yale freaked out over Halloween costumes directly. That's a very reductive treatment, what I've said so far. What they freaked the fuck out about was an email, a dissenting email, that was sent in response to a campus-wide email cautioning students about the Halloween costume choices that they made. This dissenting email, in a matter of just a few days, escalated into a campus-wide safety issue. I feel like I'm still being very negative. We're going to work on that over the next 20 minutes or so, though, okay? I promise to try. I'll even start by saying the context that's often missing from this story is that the originator of the dissenting email saying, this is silly that we're putting this much thought and censure into what people are thinking about wearing, haven't even worn yet on Halloween. This is almost like an instigation, this original email. That was some of the content of the second email that these students got really upset about. But it's not even talking directly about the whole Yale College. It's talking about a campus of Yale where students live, and they were upset because the master of a particular Yale campus, someone who is in charge of certain aspects or overseer or advisor when it comes to certain aspects of residential life, was being insensitive towards minority students. Now, a lot of us, we go, insensitive towards minority students? Yeah, okay, a real problem there. But remember our ever-widening definitions of things in higher education and how many new acts and declarations might now fit into the category of insensitivity to minority students. You know, I'm still doing it, aren't I? Maybe if we just pause for a minute and think about what this story actually contains. Before we go on, because it is going to be hard to defend, but as we explore this issue, something to contemplate would be, imagine not feeling safe in your home. And let's try to create, like, what would your bank that owns your mortgage or your landlord or your neighbor have to do to make you feel unsafe in your own home? Could it be something they say? I believe it could, right? So if this is reduction, and if I've done this before, I'm sorry. If it's like, how could people get upset by words? You know, words, I think, are usually the thing that upset us. But the content of those words is so important here. So while we try to balance this between understanding that human need for a feeling of safety, which is, you know, one of the most important needs we have, with what created the perception of danger in this situation, and we're going to let it play out. It's a challenging and frustrating exercise. And we're going to use thefire.org. This is, again, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Yale students demand resignations from faculty members over Halloween email by Haley Holder, November 6, 2015. Tensions at Yale University hit a boiling point yesterday after an email about Halloween costumes created a week-long controversy on campus. Students called for the resignation of Associate Master of Silliman College. Is that S-I-L-L-I-M-A-N? Silliman. Let me take that paragraph again. Students called for the resignation of Associate Master of Silliman College, Erica Christakis, after she responded to an email from the school's Intercultural Affairs Council asking students to be thoughtful about the cultural implications of their Halloween costumes. According to the Washington Post, students are calling for the resignation of her husband, Master of Silliman College, Nicholas Christakis, who defended her statement. Fire President and CEO Greg Lukianoff recorded video of students confronting Nicholas Christakis yesterday in the courtyard of the Silliman College dormitory complex at Yale.
I give tours every day, not every week, and have to stand here in the courtyard and say, this is my home, I live up there, my master's there, my dean, I love my college. And I can't say that anymore because it's not a home. it is no longer a safe space for me. And I find that incredibly depressing for the freshmen who are here and who don't know any better, who don't know that this was once a space where I was proud to, what I was proud to be a part of because it's a loving community. Because I feel that in your role as master and associate master, after sending that email and after not having an appropriate response, that our opinion has been dismissed. That you guys have not said, I hear you. I hear that you are hurting, and I am sorry that I have caused you to feel pain. I have not heard that from you, and I have not heard that from your wife. And that is what I want to hear. I don't want to hear any more defensive terms because it's not fair to have.
As Fire's Alex Murray wrote just last week, we see campus controversies over Halloween costumes every year. But these developments at Yale show just how intense those controversies have become. Yale students have every right to express their anger and frustration with Yale faculty, but Fire is concerned by yet another unfortunate example of students who demand upsetting opinions be entirely eradicated from the university in the name of fostering safe spaces where students are protected from hurt feelings. Practicing free speech does not merely entail the right to protest opinions you object to. It also means acknowledging people's right to hold those opinions in the first place. Recall that Yale is the source of one of the most glowing statements in support of free expression in higher education. The statement, based on the university's 1975 Woodward Report, demonstrates the need to be free to, quote, think the unthinkable, discuss the unmentionable, and challenge the unchallengeable. It even goes so far as to inform Yale students that, quote, when you agree to matriculate, you join a community where the provocative, the disturbing, and the unorthodox must be tolerated. When you encounter people who think differently than you do, you will be expected to honor their free expression, even when what they say seems wrong or offensive to you. So then we have this Intercultural Affairs Committee's Halloween email that went out on October 28th of last year. On Wednesday, Yale Dean Bergwell Howard, who wanted to buy Bushwood. I'm sorry, I added that. That was from Caddyshack. This is not all fun and games. Excuse me while I take that paragraph again. Yale Dean Bergwell Howard sent an email to Yale's entire undergraduate student body from the university's Intercultural Affairs Committee, a 13-member group of administrators from the chaplain's office, campus cultural centers, and other campus organizations. The email, titled Halloween in the Yale Community, implored students to be thoughtful about the cultural implications of their Halloween costumes and how they might offend or degrade others, pointing to costumes such as feathered headdresses, turbans, war paint, and blackface as examples of inappropriate cultural appropriation and/or misrepresentation. Howard sent a similar email to the Northwestern University community in 2010 when he was the dean of students there. While the committee's email acknowledged that students definitely have a right to express themselves, the committee hoped they would, quote, actively avoid those circumstances that threaten our sense of community or disrespects, alienates, or ridicules segments of our population based on race, nationality, religious belief, or gender expression. The committee then provided a list of questions students should ask themselves before deciding upon a costume, as well as links to websites educating students about common racial stereotypes. The committee even linked to several Pinterest boards curated by Yale's community and consent educators, one with a collection of acceptable, school-sanctioned, the school is a college, by the way, school-sanctioned costume ideas, and the other with a collection of costumes to avoid. So then, Erica Christakis's response. Just after midnight on Friday, October 30th, Erica Christakis sent an email to the Silliman community in response to the Intercultural Affairs Committee's Halloween email. Christakis explained that she and her husband, Nicholas, had heard from a number of students who were frustrated by the committee's email. Although the email was allegedly supposed to serve as a recommendation rather than a formal policy, to some, its length, tone, content, and the list of 13 signatories seemed to indicate otherwise. Christakis drew on her experiences as a child development specialist to question whether a university should dictate what students should and shouldn't wear on Halloween. She wrote, "I don't wish to trivialize genuine concerns about cultural or personal representation and other challenges to our lived experience in a plural community. I know that many decent people have proposed guidelines on Halloween costumes from a spirit of avoiding hurt and offense. I laud those goals in theory, as most of us do. But in practice, I wonder if we should reflect more transparently as a community on the consequences of an institutional, which is to say bureaucratic and administrative, exercise of implied control over college students. In addition to expressing concerns about how policing students' costumes can limit the exercise of imagination, free speech, and free expression, Christakis said, "Is there no room anymore for a child or a young person to be a little bit obnoxious, a little bit inappropriate or provocative, or, yes, offensive? American universities were once a safe space not only for maturation, but also for a certain regressive or even transgressive experience. Increasingly, it seems, they have become places of censure and prohibition." The response to Christakis's email was explosive. Bang. Nice. More than 740 Yale undergraduates, graduate students, alumni, faculty, and even students from other universities signed on to an open letter telling Christakis that her offensive email invalidates the voices of minority students on campus. 740. Christakis and her husband have since invited all Silliman signatories of the open letter, as well as any other Silliman students who might disagree with her email, to lunch this Sunday. The invitation was sharply rejected by some, including one student who, in a Yale Herald piece published today, criticized the invitation and argued that Nicholas Christakis, take a deep breath, everyone, quote, needs to stop instigating more debate. On Wednesday, more than 350 Yale undergraduates, graduate students, and faculty gathered in the Afro-American Cultural Center to attend an open forum on allegations of institutional racism on campus. The forum, which lasted more than 2 hours, addressed the daily experiences of Yale minority students and centered around two controversies: Christakis's email and allegations that members of Yale's Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity had turned away black women from a fraternity party on Friday night. The next day, shortly after a three-hour-long impromptu confrontation on cross-campus with Yale Dean Jonathan Holloway about the lack of administrative response to the week's events, around 100 students gathered in the courtyard of Silliman College to protest Christakis' email. Nicholas Christakis, who decided to meet with the student protesters, was soon encircled and accused of racism and insensitivity, with many demanding an apology for his wife's email.
Just talk louder,
I'm doing my best, everyone. I'm doing my best, okay? So I'm trying to address her directly and as a human being face to face. And I don't want to turn my back to her. And I don't want to yell at her. I'm this far if I raise my voice so you can hear me. So
thank you.
Please stop misjudging anything I do, okay?
Okay.
A little bit, I'm talking right now, right? So as I was telling you, I'll speak up a little so I won't yell at her. Is that fair?
That's fair.
All right.
Okay. All right. So what I wanted to tell you.
Christakis engaged with the students and listened to their concern for several hours. Finally, Christakis told the crowd, quote, "I apologize for causing pain, but I'm not sorry for the statement. I stand behind free speech. I defend the right of people to speak their minds," unquote. This was not the apology the students were demanding.
But you seem to think that somehow I don't agree with the content of your beliefs. And that's not what's happening from my perspective.
Can I just interject really quickly? The moral of Michaela's comment just now, the moral of the story is that she wants an apology. Yet you respond not.
That's my question.
I'm just saying, are you gonna finish? Are you going to address the heart of her comment? That's all I want. Are you gonna give an apology? Are you gonna say that you're hearing us? Are you gonna then go to the lengths that she wants you to go to, which to me don't seem very far, but still seem, we're not making a judgment on Master Christakis is inherently good. Like, we just want an acknowledgement of hurt, and we have yet to get that, which Michaela just said in the So my question is, are you going to say that or not? Because then I can just leave if you're not going to say that.
Right.
I've heard from, I was at the discussion, I was here, I'm going to be there on Sunday, and I'm going to listen, but like, what I'm listening for, I've not yet heard. So I'm just asking, are you going to provide that or are you not going to provide that?
According to the Yale Daily News, nearly half of the students left when they realized Christakis was not going to give them what they considered an appropriate apology. One student pressed Christakis on whether or not he was going to give an apology.
Are you going to provide that or are you not going to provide that?
I have to think about this idea for a moment.
The idea of apologizing.
Yes, because let me ask you this. If I ask you to apologize right now for delaying me from all my other obligations to other students.
I'm just saying.
I'm just saying. mean that the other person, you know, instantly has to say yes.
Okay, so
the person has to think about what it is that you're asking, what it means.
In another video, a student in the crowd tells other students to just walk away because he doesn't deserve to be listened to.
Other people have rights too, not just
walk,
you.
Walk away. Doesn't deserve to be listened to.
One of the stronger accusations the students made is that Christakis's refusal to apologize for his wife's email makes him unfit to be the master of Silliman. Quote, as your position as master, it is your job to create a place of comfort and home for the students that live at Silliman, one student says. You have not done that. By sending out that email, that goes against your position as master. Do you understand that? While Christakis disagreed, the student proceeded to yell at him.
Stay quiet! For all standing students, you understand that? As your position as master, it is your job to create a place of comfort and home for the students that live in Silliman. You have not done that. By sending out that email, that goes against your position as master. Do you understand that?
Then no, I stop. Don't agree with that.
Then why the fuck did you accept the position?
Because
who the fuck hired you?
I have a different vision.
You should step down! If that is what you think about being a master, you should step down! It is not about creating an intellectual space! It is not! Do you understand that? It's about creating a home here! You are not doing that!
You're supposed to be our advocate! That.
You should be at the event last night when you hear her Franco say that she didn't know how to create a safe space for her freshman in Silliman. How do you explain that? These freshmen come here, they think this is what Yale is? Do you hear that? They're going to leave. They're going to transfer because you are a poor steward of the community. You should not sleep at night.
We're out.
You are disgusting.
This student is not alone. Many other students are going as far as to demand Christakis and his wife resign from their roles as master and associate master. According to the Washington Post, students were drafting a formal letter Thursday evening calling for the removal of Christakis and her husband from their roles in Silliman. And one more section, the implications for freedom of expression and the marketplace of ideas. Are the students' protests against Christakis' protected speech? Of course. But the students' demand that the Christakis's lose their jobs for their dissident opinions represents another strong example of the phenomenon Lukianoff and social psychologist Jonathan Haidt talked about in their September cover story for The Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind. In their article, Lukianoff and Haidt argue that students are increasingly engaging in a culture of vindictive protectiveness that seeks to control campus speech in a way that not only limits free expression and chills candor, but also can produce distorted ways of thinking. This morning, Dean Holloway wrote an email to all Yale students addressing the week's controversies. In that email, he wrote that he will, quote, enforce the community standards that safeguard you as members of this community. Among those standards FIRE hopes Dean Holloway will enforce is the university's standard for freedom of expression, which I read earlier, which demands that when student and faculty members, quote, encounter people who think differently than you do, you will be expected to honor their free expression even when what they have to say seems wrong or offensive to you. As always, the best response to speech one disagrees with is more speech, not censorship. And because this was a year ago, there's a couple updates. On December 4th, the Washington Post reported that Erica Christakis was resigning from her teaching role at Yale to return to her work with young children and families. And her husband, Nicholas, announced a sabbatical during the spring 2016 semester. On May 25th, 2016, Nicholas and Erica announced that they resigned from their Silliman College duties to pursue academic work full-time. One of the most disturbing things about this whole story for me is the open letter to the Christakis's that had more than 740 signatures on it. Now, most, I would say, were students who, in some cases, probably lack the perspective. I mean, where would they have learned it? To truly understand the importance of free expression and free thought. Probably haven't had a lot of modeling of that through their K-12 experience or from the media through which they've interfaced with the world for most of their lives. And in fact, a quick scan through the list of signatories reveals many very young people, class of 2018, class of 2019. But from what I can see here, it looks like dozens of faculty members and research fellows signed this as well. In the conversation I have today with Georgetown professor John Hassness, I asked the question as to whether or not I'm being too alarmist about the outcome of practices that favor identity diversity over intellectual diversity. Even if, as Professor Hasness will reveal, there really isn't that much malevolence behind them. But do these practices still threaten real danger, I wondered. And here's what I mean. Really in the last year, really with the rise of Trump and the alt-right, a movement basically that has had a very provocative surrogate on the college campuses in the form of Milo Yiannopoulos, things have escalated. So now what scares me, what has trickled down from faculty attitudes to student attitudes, is this phenomenon of young people raised with the idea and schooled, even in higher education, in the idea that the highest aspirations of society are diversity and inclusion. Now add safety and apparently the protection from offense to that list. These ideals trump property rights, self-ownership, and even the rule of law. So when you're fighting what you perceive as racism, sexism, or bigotry, three things that have ever-expanding definitions, those ends, that fight, justify an increasingly large and antisocial collection of means, even at some of America's most prestigious educational institutions. The attitude is, in order to win this fight against what we perceive as racism, sexism, and bigotry, we will do whatever it takes to shut you up. And it doesn't take a lot of people. Yale's total student and faculty population reaches about 20,000 people. There's about 5,500 undergrads, about 6,800 graduate and professional students, 4,500 international students, and 4,400 faculty members. The efforts of less than 5% of that population led to the resignation of two people whose crime was promoting free expression and free thought. In an email. My attitude has been, and this will be up for debate in the show today, that the ideological environments at places like Yale University, which are fashioned from the top down, have made possible this hostility towards free thought, free speech, and the people who advocate them.
I have a vision of ourselves that unites our common humanity, okay? So I believe, even though I'm not like you in the sense of my superficial appearance, that I can sit down and talk to you and understand your predicament. You know, that I can listen to you. If that's not true, if you deny that, then what is the reason that you ask to be heard by me or anyone else?
Because we're dying!
Yeah, right now, look at me.
Yes.
Look at me.
Yes.
Do you understand? You and I are not the same person. We're humans. Great. Glad we understand that. But your experiences will never connect to mine. Empathy is not necessary for you to understand that you're wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay? Even if you don't feel what I feel ever, even if nobody's ever been racist to you, because they can't be racist to you, that doesn't mean that you can just act like you're not being racist.
I am sorry that I hurt your feelings. And again, using the word
can
hurt
you
your feelings, not trivializing it, okay?
Statement.
So unless someone gives me a different word
Why
so that...
Why do you care so much?
I'm apologizing again. She says to me...
I don't want to use the word pain.
No, pain. I'm sorry I caused you pain. Yes, I'm willing
you.
To say that too. Yes,
what
thank
you. What you did was create space for violence to happen.
That I disagree with.
I disagree.
It's not a debate. Yes, and I apologize. I'm sorry I said to her.
You should know me by now. I agree, Jency. This is my home, and you came in here. You adopt to me. Do you understand that?
Yes,
you take care of me, and you haven't been doing that, and I've kept quiet.
I apologize for causing pain. I was looking for the right words.
Guys,
you have
hello?
Created space
really quick.
For violence.
I disagree with that. I disagree with that.
You don't get a choice here.
I disagree. I disagree that I've fostered violence. I disagree with that statement.
Can I just really quickly?
Yes. What is your name?
You don't need to bend down.
I'm not bending. What's your name?
I don't want to. I do not want to shake your
okay.
hand. I do not want. I do not respect you.
And now I want your job to be taken from you. I don't want you to have this job. I am disgusted knowing that you work at Yale University, where I will get my degree. You want free dialogue? You want free speech? This is how it works. Someone speaks, you listen. You do not cut them off. You do not do these condescending gestures. You do not smirk.
Yes.
You look them in the face and you wait. You wait until it is your turn. It was not your turn when your wife sent out that email. It was not your turn. It was our turn to send out an email to the students and tell them not to appropriate our cultures or denigrate us, to respect us. It was not your turn, sir. It has never been your fucking turn for a long time. You've had your turn.
So in my conversation with Professor Hasness, I tried to expand beyond just faculty hiring practices to talk about this whole higher education environment that has been created. We talked primarily about top-down limitations on intellectual diversity as far as faculty hiring practices, which are honestly more the consequences of the environment than a conscious discrimination against ideas type of project. But do those top-down limitations on intellectual diversity devolve into a bottom-up elimination of intellectual diversity? That's what concerns me. So I came into this discussion with Professor Hasness thinking that this lack of faculty ideological diversity in favor of identity diversity is an active part of the project to eliminate intellectual diversity that's really being encouraged now by a lot of students. So this is my big picture. And I think in this discussion with John Hasness, I expected his story would fit into that big picture. But it didn't exactly, and that was very interesting. Now, maybe Professor Hasness hasn't really seen Milo's escapades on college campuses. And maybe he doesn't watch things like The Daily Show, which I see for many of these kids. I think it's reasonable to assume that it is a significant source of information and influence, second only, in some cases, not too far behind the attitudes of a very ideologically uniform group of college professors. Maybe he has a more narrow focus, especially at a private university like Georgetown that's probably immune to a lot of what we've seen. But that's good because at least during this conversation, it forces me to view this whole scene through a certain lens and a certain lighting setup for a while. It might not be the most provocative or entertaining setup, but it's a perspective that's very, very important in truly understanding what's happening in higher education right now. So thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy this conversation. My guest today is John Hasness. He is a professor of business at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business and a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C., where he teaches courses in ethics and law. Professor Hasness is also the executive director of the Georgetown Institute for the Study of Markets and Ethics. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much.
Despite the objectionable title of my program, I sincerely want to help college-age students and even high school-age students who are possibly preparing to go to college to develop a more nuanced and less cartoonish understanding of what is currently happening in higher education. My show has a definite libertarian bent, and I think a lot of us are seeing this left wing. This phrase you used was ideological insularity, and because we lack experience or context, we don't understand it. So many of us, often from a vantage point of some ignorance, are compelled to say collusion or conspiracy. But that's not really correct. And my role is to try to have a less hostile, even if it might sometimes mean a less entertaining presentation. So that's where somebody with your background comes in and tries to help elucidate these issues. So my first question to you would be, through your observations and experience, how would you explain the lack of intellectual diversity on college campuses?
There is a lack of ideological diversity in the sense that most professors in certain disciplines tend to be to the left of center, and there's a great deal of imbalance. The explanation really has nothing to do with any kind of collusion, and there's not some kind of administrative bias in one direction or another. It's simply that people tend to evaluate other people's work based on their presuppositions and what they think is correct. Now, there's a large number of people who are left of center when they evaluate other people's work. They tend to think work like their own is good, and they're more skeptical of work from opposing point of views, especially if someone seems to be quite radical. It's hard to convince mainstream people that radical ideas represent good work. And so it's just a self-perpetuating bias where people tend to like work that reinforces their own beliefs. And it just so happens that the makeup of the academy right now in many disciplines is predominantly left-leaning.
And how long do you think that this situation has existed? It's certainly nothing new.
Yes, it's not new. And it's also not uniform. So I work in a business school and in a law school. Those are two very different institutions. Business schools and engineering schools, science schools are not highly ideological in one way or another. However, social sciences, normative pursuits, law schools, that's where you tend to have more of a one-sided set of faculty members. And that's been that way for quite a while. The explanation, and I'll give you an explanation which on my part simply represents speculation.
Okay.
But a career as an academic tends to be more attractive to people who see defects in the way society is organized, the way markets work. They would like to make the world a better place by correcting these defects, and it's a career that's more attractive to people with a left-leaning orientation with regard to political and ethical and normative matters like that. So to some extent, this simply may be a self-selection bias. At least that's the way it gets started. Once it's started, it tends to be self-reproducing, because when you have a large percentage of people thinking one way, then they tend to see other people who think the same way as doing better work.
Indeed. Now, you've been a professor at Georgetown for more than two decades at this point, and during that time, you've participated in the search process many times for new faculty. So let's discuss that process a little bit. Along these same lines, while you were on search committees, did you ever notice any, you know, requirements or limitations that you found particularly interesting or perhaps even alarming?
Generally speaking, all of the people that I've been working with on search committees share the same view, which is they want to hire the best people they can to be faculty members. They're hiring people who are going to teach students and also be colleagues, and they just want to hire the best people they can. So there's almost never overt bias or prejudice. The bias works covertly when the judgment is made as to who the best candidates are. So there's rarely overt bias. Now, I have been involved in a couple of cases in which there was overt bias. It was just declared at one point that they would not consider any libertarian candidates. But that kind of bias was much more relevant to sort of the internal dynamics and the internal politics of what was going on here rather than some view that we shouldn't have anybody like that in the academy. After all, I was here, and I'm very libertarian in outlook. So the way I think it's mostly something that works covertly. It's very rare that you'll see overt bias along ideological lines. There is very overt bias along genetic and sexual lines because there's a strong drive to create a more diverse faculty with regard to women and members of minority groups or protected classes. So that's a much more motivating consideration than ideology.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in a minute. I've had a lot of conversations in the recent past on this issue of college race tensions and diversity with a former Occidental professor named Thaddeus Russell, who you may or may not be familiar with. He wrote a book called Renegade History of the United States, and he does some work for Reason.com. And, you know, you talk about overt versus covert bias. His assessment was people don't even notice it. Like, for you to say that you, even though it was a selective example, that at one point you were in a search committee where the chair said no libertarian candidates will be considered, that's a pretty extreme example, because usually these things don't even rise to the surface of needing to be said. It's just that's the way it is. The ideologies that exist in higher education are what's normal, what's reasonable, everything else is just an ideology from that viewpoint. Is that fair to say that there doesn't even really need to be that much discussion about what a person thinks, because generally people think the same?
It's fair to say it's entirely accurate. That is the case. But I also point out that it's not limited to one side. There are very few academic institutions that are predominantly right of center.
Mm-hmm.
My career, I've been associated with one of them. And in that group, most people were right of center, and they were all completely objective in evaluating candidates. It just so happened that the candidates that they judged to be doing good work were candidates who did right of center work, and they regarded the left or left-leaning work as poor work. So the bias works subtly and unconsciously. It's people just tend to like work that reflects their own beliefs. And because most of the academy right now is left-leaning, that's bias that gets reproduced in most places. But it's not a left-right thing. It's simply a us and them type of thing.
Sure, sure, absolutely. So there is an interesting phenomenon that you captured in two pieces that you wrote, both within the last year, when it comes to contrasting identity politics diversity with actual intellectual or ideological diversity. The first one you wrote 11 months ago, November 2015, for Forbes. It was called "The Surprising Obstacle Mizzou and Yale Face in Increasing Diversity." In that, you outline this fairly challenging legal terrain. The people who want to increase diversity, the university administration, are going to face. And there's actually considerable obstacles in doing what the protesting students at the time demanded. Contrast that, and we're going to talk about both of these in more detail, with a piece that you wrote for the Wall Street Journal. And just a production note here, I will put your version of this article linked on your website in my show notes, because the Wall Street Journal did edit the piece. It was called "The One Kind of Diversity That Colleges Avoid," where you talk about, all right, well, there's all these, you know, you discussed in the previous article, well, there's all these challenges legally to what the students want the administration to do as far as identity is concerned, but there are no obstacles to increasing intellectual diversity, yet, strangely enough, there is still almost none of it. So that's the path for the rest of the conversation here. Let's start with the piece that you wrote for Forbes and this legal terrain. The students at these schools, Mizzou was one, and there were a few others. The students, I guess, basically said that the university had failed in creating a welcoming and safe environment for minority students. And part of the problem was a lack of diversity. But there are substantial challenges in just increasing the diversity of a faculty, right?
Yes, and the challenges are legal challenges. It has to do with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I'll sort of give you an overview of what the hiring process is like if we're going to do it legally.
Mm-hmm.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits making employment decisions on the basis of race, religion, sex, and national origin. Now, for hiring faculty, that's an employment decision. Many people are familiar with and have read about recent decisions by the Supreme Court having to do with admitting students to college, and that's a major issue. But hiring faculty is an employment discrimination issue, and it's covered by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We're not talking about the Equal Protection Clause. The way the Civil Rights Act works, we can legally engage in very, very vigorous affirmative action efforts when we're trying to recruit people to apply for our position. So informing a pool of applicants, we can do whatever we want to encourage minorities, protected groups, and women to apply. And that's where affirmative action plays a role and is legal. Once we have our applicant pools formed, if we're going to obey the law, from that point on, when the selection process starts, we're not allowed to consider any of the protected categories. So we're not supposed to make any judgments on the basis of race, religion, national origin, or sex. That doesn't mean that people don't do that, but legally, we're not supposed to do that.
Right.
So if universities would like to increase the number of minority faculty members or female faculty members, it can't just go out and say, we're hiring women, we're hiring African-Americans, we're hiring Hispanics, apply and we'll definitely hire on this basis. It's not legal. You can't do it. Civil Rights Act prohibits it. You have to do a search and you have to evaluate the applications from all of the applicants, and you're supposed to do it fairly. And as a result, universities can't simply go out and do what the student activists want them to do, which is hire people based on their race or ethnic background or their sex. The reason why places like Brown, which I think is starting a $1 million program to hire more diverse faculty, and Yale, which I think is devoting $50 million to it, the reason why it's so expensive is that what they're going to have to do is create new faculty positions in fields that make it extremely likely that minorities or the protected classes would be the leading candidates, because you can't simply go out and hire on a racial basis. It would be illegal.
Okay, yeah, that's very interesting. So we're obviously talking about the possibility of huge amounts of waste that could possibly translate to significant increases in tuition beyond the astronomical increases we've already seen in the last couple decades then, right?
Well, places like Yale and Brown have large endowments, and
yeah,
they must be judging that the expenditure of these large sums from their endowments is worthwhile. I work at Georgetown University. We don't have that kind of money available to use for these purposes. Georgetown is engaged in vigorous affirmative action efforts, or I'm sorry, diversity efforts, but we have to do it within our budget, and we're supposed to do it legally, and that is very difficult and time-consuming and takes many years.
Absolutely. So just to make sure that I'm understanding you as far as the process is concerned, all they can really do as far as administrations are concerned is, I know this sounds like a negative phrase, but stack the deck as far as the pool is concerned. They have a lot of flexibility as far as generating a candidate pool. They can't actually make the decision based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Once the selection process starts, those factors cannot legally be considered. Now, I don't want to make it seem as though the people making the decision don't consider those things.
Sure, sure.
If they do, legally we're not supposed to, and when we are discussing who the best candidates are, we're not supposed to bring up those factors as a basis for decision.
Right. That makes sense. So last year, when all of this was heating up, you said that the university administrators involved really had their integrity on the line regarding how they were going to approach this with students. It seemed like the options were they could either say, well, we can't do it. You know, the law doesn't allow what you're asking us to do. They could promise something they couldn't deliver as another option, or they could just continue to do the same thing they were doing and, I guess, make a PR campaign designed to pacify the students out of essentially maintaining the status quo. Those were their options.
Yes, I think university administrations are in a very difficult position because no university administration can go out and say to activists, we will engage in racially or sexually or ethnically preferential hiring. They can't say we're going to violate the Civil Rights Act
right. In
public, because they wouldn't commit to that. They do want to tell activists that they're making serious diversity efforts, but the activists are activists because they're not satisfied with the pace at which things are going, and I'm a professor. I'm not sure what universities can legally do to increase the pace at which diversity is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And so administrations, they want to make representations as though they're going to make more vigorous actions, but they're already doing almost everything that can be done. And that's why a place like Yale or Brown would announce we're devoting $50 or $100 million to create new positions, because that's the only thing that they can do to accelerate the process.
Indeed. So just to shift directions a little bit, what is, I, from my experience in and around higher education, it seems like the attitudes of those at the top, be they the administration or the faculty, have a very obvious way of trickling down to the student population. So if this starts at the top, what are their justifications for diversity? I know it sounds like an almost taboo question to ask in this climate, but this is something that started a while ago. So what were the justifications for having a diverse faculty and even a diverse student body?
Okay, it's a good question. Many years ago, decades ago, people were talking in terms of affirmative action and remedying discrimination. But right now, the discussion is in having a more diverse faculty. So the way it's described is the value of diversity. And when I looked into this, there are at least four reasons introduced in support of having a more diverse faculty. I'll quickly tell you what they are. The first is that a more diverse academic environment would better prepare students for an increasingly diverse workforce and society, and it will help them develop skills they need in the global workplace. So that's one.
Mm-hmm.
Second reason offered is that a diverse faculty provides students with role models that demonstrate that people from all backgrounds can achieve intellectual excellence and are worthy of respect. Another one is that learning requires the robust exchange of ideas, and that's enhanced when faculty have the greatest possible variety of backgrounds. And then the fourth one I found is that being exposed to people from different backgrounds breaks down unfair stereotypes and promotes understanding of others. So those are the four supporting reasons usually introduced. And if you were to ask me, I think those all are good reasons. Those are good reasons why you would want a more diverse faculty. The reason why I wrote the Wall Street Journal piece is because if they're good reasons for diversity, they apply equally well to intellectual diversity as they do to diversity, sexual diversity or genetic diversity or racial diversity. So if those are good reasons, and that's why we would want people with many different political and ideological viewpoints as well as different races and sexes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, to me, like when I read that, it and you could totally disagree with me. You can say, Brett, calm down. You're being hysterical here. You're reading into this too much. But that those reasons expose a kind of toxicity of left-wing thinking to me, and that there's this kind of paternalism. Because when I read that paragraph in your article, it's like, yeah, I would think very few people would make it to college without already being aware of the need for these things. So there's this attitude, and like I said, I'm very negative about this stuff and I'm working on it. There's this attitude of paternalism that not only do we need to go and find these people from disadvantaged groups and elevate them to these positions, we also need to tell our current students what they need, because they wouldn't know how important these four things are after just 18 years of life if we didn't provide that information for them. So it's very top-down and paternalistic. Some people might say that's subtle or I'm reading too much into it, but what do you think?
I have perhaps an idiosyncratic view of the argument for diversity that's advanced along these lines with regard to academic hiring. How can I put this? I think diversity is a legitimate value.
Okay.
And it's worth pursuing. I think what's wrong is the way it's being pursued. And what I mean by this is the quest for diversity, the way it's pursued right now, is about cost shifting and not about attaining its goal. That needs some explanations.
Sure.
All right. So let me do a little thought experiment with you. I'm going to suggest that we could have a fully diverse faculty next year, and all of these issues could be settled. Here's how it could happen. There are a large number of current faculty who think we need to have a more diverse faculty across the board. Mm-hmm. Many of the people who believe that are themselves white male professors who are tenured or tenure-track professors, and they strongly believe that there should be more women and minorities in the academic faculties of universities. Now, next year, all of those people who believe that could get together, voluntarily agree to put their name in a hat, and have the correct number of places selected, and then those people could resign.
Right.
And then the schools could simply replace them with the amount of minorities and women that would create a diverse faculty, and we would be done in 1 year. And it requires no coercion. It only requires the people who have this belief to have the strength of their convictions. The reason why diversity is something that's controversial and takes a long time is because the people who are in favor of diversity want the result, but they want other people to pay the cost. They want the cost to be shifted to current people who are looking for jobs and don't have them. Instead of people who already have the jobs having to sacrifice something, they just want the entire burden to be placed on the next generation. But that means it's very slow, and it takes a long time through natural attrition to fill in these spots. So diversity, if it's valuable, could be achieved next year if the advocates had the strength of their convictions and were willing to sacrifice something themselves. It only takes a very long time if you want other people to bear the burden and you don't want to bear any of the burden yourself. So my opposition is probably to the method that's being used rather than the goal that's being pursued.
I'm hearing you say that, and it makes me realize why I think a lot of people describe left-wing thinking in higher education as ivory tower. People love to talk about things, but in a way that's disconnected from the real world and really taking action to bring about those things. And when there are actions to take, it's always somebody else's actions. It usually seems, just as I've observed the higher education climate over the last year, somebody else needs to stop doing something wrong.
Yes, that's often the case.
Yeah.
Of course, you can always criticize professors as being ivory tower types who want to think about things and not do anything. When you get right down to it, professors are just like everyone else, like politicians and like ordinary people. We're driven by concerns of what's in our interest and by personal as well as philosophical considerations. So it's certainly possible to be a very strong supporter of affirmative action, but not be willing to give up your position in order to make it be realistic. I mean, there are a lot of people who support going to war in other countries without being willing to enlist in the military in order to do so. There's the disconnect is between the desired end and the cost you might have to bear personally to achieve it. That's fairly general, and it applies to us in the academic world just as much as anyplace else. I don't think we're special in that way. I think we're human in that way, but it explains a lot of our behavior and our thinking.
Yeah, I think the whole issue, and maybe I could have done a better job of explaining this, it brings out the libertarian in me, for sure, which is very present anyway. If somebody says, I want more diversity on my college campus, and the response is, okay, then you're white, so leave. That is kind of a ridiculous follow-up. And I don't think that people, just because they have this desire, should have to take such a drastic action that affects their life in a negative way. But what does seem to be encouraged is these solutions delivered by force against other people. That's what makes me perk up, right? Because there's a lot of calls for that in, you know, the left in higher education and beyond higher education on a variety of issues. Like, we will use force against you, which I think is why some of these things become so incendiary and hostile.
So maybe I am libertarian. I'm very libertarian. Maybe despite that, we see things differently. In describing the problem in achieving diversity, I had to talk about the requirements of the Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And as a Georgetown professor, I agreed to obey the law, therefore I have to abide by it. But in my own thinking, I don't support the Civil Rights Act when it's applied to private universities. In my opinion, Georgetown University as a private institution should be free to hire faculty in a way that it decides best advances its mission. And if Georgetown were to decide that its mission would be better advanced by giving preferential hiring treatment to members of minority groups or women, I would be perfectly fine with the university doing that because I'm libertarian and I don't support coercive intervention over private choices. Remember that the Civil Rights Act, although it's widely supported, is the government restricting the freedom of choice of private parties. So I don't have anything against diversity and other forms of affirmative action when they're voluntarily undertaken because the people who are engaging in that believe it's the right thing to do and are exercising their free choice. I would be opposed to it if it was coercively imposed on private parties. As it stands right now, the Civil Rights Act doesn't permit explicit race-based hiring. It only permits a weakened form of affirmative action, so that I don't see the problem being some kind of external coercive force working on this. Universities are responding to activists, to public pressure, to the high-profile people who can make these kind of arguments, and it's simply a response to non-coercive but apparently effective methods of public persuasion.
I agree with everything that you're saying, and of course, even in the opposition to not the idea behind the Civil Rights Act, but the imposition of force that it requires. And I understand that in that first piece that you wrote for Forbes, you're using it as a device. And I think it even points out a kind of hypocrisy that's going on, that it's so coveted by so many of these people, but it's also kind of being, they're steering around it to get what they want. So I agree with everything that you said. I think that, through my experience, I worked in education for a long time, mostly as a teacher, and then I ran a educational services company. I have a sensitivity about indoctrination, which I don't really think you can say is the outright use of force, even though it's obviously made possible, at least in the public system, through taxation. But when I see these narratives being forced on the minds of people, that's why I take this more hostile position. But just I want the record to show that you and I do agree.
Yeah, sure. And I'm opposed to indoctrination also because I think that's a very ineffective and poor way of teaching.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
But there is indoctrination of certain types in certain cases, and it's good to oppose that, but that's not the core problem. The core problem, or something that would be the analog of indoctrination, is what actually takes place, which is just ignoring large chunks of viewpoints. So most of my colleagues don't try to indoctrinate their students. They simply teach them, and they leave out of the curriculum the kind of viewpoints that I would think would be important. I know plenty of students who go through entire economic programs, and they've never heard of Hayek,
sure,
or who will do political philosophy but simply never have some of the classical liberals in the reading list. It's not indoctrination as much as selecting what the professors think is important to look at, and since large sections are left out, students never hear about them. That's the real danger.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's why we've seen such an escalation in hostility over the last year, because these things are never given any attention in that study. And then if a student suddenly is confronted by these things, like say, all of a sudden, not that he's any kind of a spokesperson for libertarianism, but Milo Yiannopoulos shows up on your college campus. Well, that's a really ugly scene. if you, you know, haven't even been introduced to the idea that the other ideologies even exist, people fight against these things that they don't understand and thus obviously don't agree with, or they're made to feel uncomfortable. They fight them very energetically. And I think that's why we have seen a lot of the ugly incidents on college campus in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I'm very concerned by these kinds of incidents as well, like you are. I don't think that this is necessarily related to the topic we're discussing, which is faculty diversity.
Sure.
I know at Georgetown, I am doing what I can to get Georgetown University to sign on to the declaration made by the faculty of the University of Chicago that commits the University of Chicago to upholding free speech on campus. I think we should do the same thing here. And I think it's important to maintain a campus environment in which people can argue back and forth, but we don't try to shut down any viewpoints because they're either unpopular or make people feel uncomfortable. I think that's a really serious, important issue in university campuses today. It's one we should engage in. I think it's completely independent of the attempt to get a more diverse faculty, but it's probably something that's even more important to focus our attention on these days. Georgetown University is institutionally committed to freedom of expression. It's highly institutionally committed to freedom of expression. On the other hand, it is at the same time highly committed to maintaining a comfortable learning environment. And as a private institution, we're bound by our own public commitments. So right now, we have two public commitments which conflict with each other.
Yeah.
And I would like to see us officially say we're committed to both, but freedom of expression is the more important one. And when they come into conflict, we'll support freedom of expression over making the students comfortable. So this is something that's internal to Georgetown. I think we should make our commitments clearer to the students who are coming in and to the public generally. And I hope we do so, but when you do something at a university, it often takes a long time to go through the internal bureaucratic process. I was hoping we would have done this sooner, but I'll be happy if we do it eventually.
Absolutely. And learning can be uncomfortable sometimes and challenging. And I think students should have the attitude that that's okay. I hope more of them wind up developing that. I'm sure it's fairly common, but I would like to see it more widespread than it appears to be in higher education right now. So I want to say thank you for taking the time to share your wisdom and your experience on these matters. And do you have a website where you have this extensive legal background, if there were people in my audience who are interested in reading some of your work, is there a place they could go?
Yes, if you're interested in my work, I do have a website at Georgetown University. And on my website, I've posted versions of almost all of my articles. So they're available. And that way people can download them rather than having to go and get them out of the library in that way.
Excellent.
But for me, it's very easy to find my website and my articles because the six letters of my last name, Hasnas, are unique to me and members of my family. There are no Hasnases in the on the web in the United States other than us or people back in Romania that don't have English websites. So you can simply find me with those six letters.
Hasnas. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, Professor Hasnas, thank you so much for your time and have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. You'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.